Well, I hope you're encouraged by seeing so many young people ready to head out as they work together with not only the leaders in this church, but those who are involved in other churches, and many of the youth pastors and youth workers in the town work together to bring the gospel to another needy part of Bangor. But I'm delighted that we are able to get the young people here tonight, because we've been staying in the book of Proverbs over these Sunday nights together. And if you're just joining us tonight, the main reason we tackled the book of Proverbs is this: because we believe in a world that is constantly changing, God's word, which is unchangeable, has so much to say to it. Then a culture that is constantly changing and constantly moving, God's word, which is unchangeable, has so much to say to our generation. Solomon, who is the author of many of these Proverbs, is an older man. And he's writing to his young sons, perhaps in their sort of early teens, probably an 11 or 12-year-old boy. That's who the Proverbs are targeting at. And if you read Ecclesiastes, you'll see that Solomon, who was one of the wisest men ever to walk the earth, tasted every pleasure imaginable. He had all the women that you could desire. He had all the lands that you could desire. And many would say that he was the wealthiest man to have been walking about the planet at this particular time and particular culture. And yet at the end of Ecclesiastes, another book in the wisdom literature of the Bible, he said, after tasting all that this world had to offer, he said it was meaningless. He said the main thing that he wanted his young sons to remember is this: fear God and keep the commandments. And so the book of Proverbs is really a book for you and I to understand tonight, to help us understand how to get along in this world. How to be a young person looking into the future in a world that's constantly changing, to say, how shall I then live? Or as a middle-aged person in the particular sphere of life that we find ourselves, how then should we live? Or as a more mature person wondering how to live out the last number of days in our lives, you say, how then should we live? The book of Proverbs has something to say to each one of us. And tonight, Solomon is going to tackle for his sons what sort of a woman they should marry. So young person, if you're looking to get married, this is the sort of woman that you need to be. Or if you're a man, this is the sort of woman you've got to look for. Or if you're single, this is the sort of person that you're to be within the church to serve Jesus Christ, his bride. And so we've got so much to learn tonight. As Solomon tackles what sort of wife his sons are to look for. I read an article in the Daily Mail on the 23rd of November that said this: Until relatively recently in our history, exceptionally bright women were not often given the place they should. In Victorian Britain, for example, the opportunities for a woman to earn her living through brain power alone were extremely limited. According to the 1901 census, there were fewer than 100 registered female doctors in the whole of the United Kingdom. Going to university was difficult and expensive. Most did not even allow girls to study. There were certainly few opportunities for careers in engineering or the sciences. You could become a teacher or a governess, or maybe, if you were exceptionally talented, earn your living writing or in the arts. Most of the professions were closed, as was the world of business. Brainy women were not even seen as particularly desirable partners. Clever or rich men chose brides on the grounds of looks, breeding, or both. Having an IQ in the 140s probably counted against you, if anything. The traditional image of a dumb blonde hanging off the arm of the successful politician or businessman was a horrible cliche, but it had an element of truth in this society. And in any case, a very clever woman would often have been mad to have got married to this sort of man. 50 years ago, from our current climate, male airline pilots typically married stewardesses. Now they marry other pilots. Doctors used to marry nurses, but now they marry other doctors. Until the 1880s, British women who wed could not even own their own property. If she did have a job, many employers would automatically sack a girl the moment she turned up with an engagement ring. So many clever women simply did not marry, or married late, and probably had fewer children when they did. But then the writer said this: but now everything has changed. Not only have the legal and social barriers to women entering the workplace as equals been largely dismantled, we also have the phenomenon of the desirable alpha female. 50 years ago, many men were scared of smart women. Now, increasingly, alpha males want someone their equal or even superior. 50 years ago, male airline pilots, as we've heard, typically married stewardesses. Now they marry these other pilots. So what has happened? A lot has changed from the particular culture and climate which Solomon wrote into. And as I spend much of my time analyzing the culture that we live in, there are two things I know with absolute certainty. Extreme chauvinism is wrong, and I believe extreme feminism is wrong. Extreme chauvinism is wrong, and extreme feminism is wrong. And yet we have to then ask, well then, how then should we live? What has the writer, what has Solomon to say to us, who wrote these words under the inspiration of God, the Holy Spirit, say to us in our society, in particular the role of a woman here in a marriage setting, how should her life look like? So, this is my title. What does an omnicompetent woman look like? I was just going to insert Jenny beside it, because I'm looking for bonus points. What does an omnicompetent woman look like? One person said about the Proverbs 31 woman, if you're turning there, Proverbs 31 verses 10 and following, we'll find out what an omnicompetent woman looked like in Solomon's eyes. One writer said of her, she had no blemish apart from her perceived perfection. But what we'll see tonight is this. This is a woman who is wise. This is a woman who is industrious. This is a woman who is socially engaged. This is a woman who is affectionate. This woman is devoted to her family. This woman is committed. She is merciful and she has entrepreneurial skill. So this is a woman who makes an outstanding contribution to her husband, to her family, to enterprise, and to the community. But I believe Solomon has much to say too. As some people think that this is the writing of King Lemuel, as you'll see in chapter 31, verses 1 to 10. But I don't think so personally. I think it's back to Solomon himself writing. And Solomon chose his partners badly. He's much to say about choosing the right spouse for life. Solomon, tragically, was so eager to forge an alliance with Egypt that he chose Pharaoh's daughter and married outside the people of God. The marriage turned out to be a disaster. 2 Chronicles 8 verse 11 hints that Solomon knew that he should never have married her, but he let her and otherwise lead him astray into idolatry and the worship of other gods. Jehoshaphat was another godly king of Judah between Solomon and Hezekiah, but even he chose his son's future wife badly. He had a passion for unity among God's people, and that made him tolerant towards the northern kingdom of Israel. And he chose the wicked King Ahab and Queen Jezebel as the co-pilot for his son in life. And so Proverbs teaches us how to choose a life partner wisely. And so if you're married, this is a chapter that describes the spouse that wisdom will teach you to be. If you're single, this chapter will tell you to choose the right co-pilot for life with you. If you know that you're going to remain single like Jesus or Paul, this chapter tells you the kind of Christian God calls you to be as you play your part in his church, the bride of Christ, and to devote yourself to serving Jesus, the great bridegroom. But this is a very interesting piece of poetry, Proverbs 31. It's a poem that's skillfully crafted. It's what the writer would have called an acrostic. Each verse begins with the successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It's also chiastic in structure, and to combine both of these structures and these two devices together was one of the cleverest ways you could ever have written a poem. You see, you and I have a Bible in front of us, or we have a tablet in front of us which has the Bible on it. But in the days that Solomon's sons would have received these, it would have been through the oral tradition. They would have had to have memorized these things. And so the writer of this poem has done everything to help his sons remember what sort of a wife they should look for. Or if you're a lady tonight, what sort of lady that you should have been. Derek Kidner says this about the book of Proverbs as he leans towards the end of Proverbs 31. It's a book which seldom takes you to church. like its own figure of wisdom, it calls across to you in the street about some everyday matter, or points things out at the home. Its function in Scripture is to put godliness into working clothes, to name business and society as spheres in which we are to acquit ourselves with credit to our Lord, in which we're to look for His training. And in the book of Proverbs, Lady Wisdom has been described. In a sense, when Solomon is writing to his sons about what wisdom is, he refers to wisdom in the female variety. But he also talks about avoiding females that will bring him harm, bring his sons harm. The adulteress who, her words are dripping with honey, seeking to entice a young man to come and go to bed with her. And so there are many examples of the lady in a negative way, and yet there are many examples of wisdom being personified through a ladyship herself. But this woman at the end is the omnicompetent woman. She is totally omnicompetent. And there are many wise women in the Bible, the wise women of Tekoa, 2 Samuel 14, Rahab, Ruth, Deborah, and Esther. But what about this woman? Let's dive down into the text to see what Solomon has to say about this omnicompetent woman. The first thing about her is she puts God and family first. She puts God and family first. So let's read verse 10 of chapter 31. A wife of noble character, who can find? She is worth far more than rubies. And this word for moral character is the word that Solomon used, hayel, meaning of moral strength. He would have used it elsewhere in Proverbs 12, verse 4. A wife of noble character, a wife of hayel, is her husband's crown, but a disgraceful wife is like decay in her bones. And there are many writers who actually think that the Proverbs 31 woman was Ruth, the book of Ruth, some of you know it. Because the word Hayel is used to describe Ruth. Naomi, when speaking to Ruth, said this in Ruth 3, verse 11. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character, of Hayel character. But the amazing thing about this Proverbs 31 woman is that the writer says nothing about her physical appearance. He says absolutely nothing about her physical appearance. And yet you and I live in a culture which is totally obsessed with physical appearance. And the first thing that Solomon wants his young sons to know is this: if you're going to look for a wife, the first thing that you should look for is her moral character. Does she fear God? Does she love God? Is she consumed with God? It's the first thing he wants them to look for. And we know in the Bible that God is obsessed with not the outward, but the inward. In 1 Samuel 16, verse 7, the Lord had to rebuke Samuel. He said, do not consider, when he was choosing the next king of Israel, he said, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things that man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. The Lord looks at the heart. And so Solomon says, a wife of noble character, who can find? Who can find her? It's not that she doesn't exist. Rather, she is of surpassing value to the person that finds her. We see this wife of noble character in Proverbs 18, verse 22. He who finds a wife finds what is good and receives favor from the Lord. Proverbs 19, verse 14, houses and wealth are inherited from parents, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. And then the question is, well, how much is she worth? As he's speaking to his sons, and he wants his sons to understand how they're to grow up in this world and what sort of a wife to choose, he's then saying, well, how much are they worth? Look what he says, verse 10. They're worth far more than rubies. Far more than rubies. And we have known that in Proverbs. Proverbs 3 verse 15. She is more precious than rubies. Nothing you can desire can compare with her. Speaking of wisdom. Again, speaking of wisdom. In Proverbs 8 verse 11. For wisdom is more precious than rubies. And nothing you desire can compare with her. Because you see, Solomon was saying, if you find a wife that fears the Lord, what you will find is a wise woman. You'll find the wisest woman in the world if she fears God, because what she then will begin to think will be God's thoughts after him. And she will be a wise woman that'll be worth far more than rubies. In fact, Solomon said, I know, guys, I inherited all the wealth of the world, I had all the women in the world, but you see, a woman that fears the Lord, it actually trumps everything else. Countercultural in Solomon's day, and I can assure you, countercultural today. But our culture doesn't think like this. The National Lottery statistics tell us that millions of people in the UK play the National Lottery once or twice a week and expectantly check their numbers when the draw is announced. But why? Why, I believe, is because they seriously think that if they win the jackpot, they will find the true meaning for their life. All their problems will disappear. And in fact, statistically, if you trace many of the great winners of the National Lottery jackpot, it destroys their lives. Because some of us know, as we've studied the rest of the Bible, that it says the love of money is the root of every kind of evil. And so Solomon experienced that lure and that wealth of money, and he says, a wife of godly character, putting God first and her family first, she's worth far more than rubies. Again, Solomon would speak in Proverbs 17, verse 16, of what use is money in the hand of a fool, since he has no desire to get wisdom. Again, statistically, it tells me there are many wealthy and famous people in the United Kingdom. Apparently, one in every 5,000 people is a millionaire. But how many wise people are there? Solomon is saying here, look for a godly woman who puts God first and puts her family first. And what sort of impact will it have on their heart? Look at verse 11. Solomon is saying, this is the sort of impact this will have on your heart. Her husband, verse 11, has full confidence in her and lacks nothing of value. This woman is one of fidelity to her husband and to her family, to her industry, and through her wisdom. I found something that made me laugh during the week. Historically, this particular book said that women at home were not always trustworthy. The husband might have been away on business, and before he left, he would have locked up all the valuables. But why? Because sometimes a wife would have used up all the family resources on the strangest items while he was away. Then I was thinking of our modern day culture. It sounds like the wife that could just go online with the credit card and the debit card and go mad while someone was out of the room. But apparently, historically, that was the case, as a man might go away because he didn't have the full trust, perhaps, of his wife. And the wife may not have trusted the husband either as he went on his business trip. There wasn't a sense of fidelity towards one another. And so there was no trust. And in a sense, there wasn't a marriage. But this woman is faithful to her husband. And what happens then, verse 12? What impact does this have on him? Verse 12 says, she brings him good. Not just at the beginning of their marriage, but all the days of her life. She continually loves him in sickness and in health, in good times and bad, in the springtime of youthful romance, and in the waning years of declining age. Her love, based on principles, knows no bounds. Why? Because the source of her love for her husband is not based on something from within herself. It's based on God's love for her, and then her love for her husband. You see, this woman, this omnicompetent woman, puts God first and her family first. But secondly, she's got lots of time still to do other things. She is a hardworking entrepreneur. She's a hardworking entrepreneur. Look at verse 13. Can I just say, ladies, by the end of this, you're going to be throwing rocks at me? Because this woman is unbelievable. You'll just trust me. If you think it's bad now, it gets worse. Verse 13. She selects wool and flax and works with eager hands. In the age long before the Industrial Revolution, women had to work at spinning wool and making clothes in every spare moment. And fidelity in this labor was a mark of feminine virtue. And so this woman is selecting, carefully selecting the best wool. Although older daughters and servants may have helped her in the making of the clothes, this noble wife of moral virtue is supervising and no doubt participating in the making of these items with wool and flax. And yet Paul, the apostle, also spoke into what sort of a life a woman might make within a family household. He wrote to Timothy, a young pastor at Ephesus, and said in 1 Timothy 5:10, "She is well known for her good deeds, such as bringing up children, showing hospitality, washing the feet of the saints, helping those in trouble, and devoting herself to all kinds of good deeds." Paul then wrote to another young pastor called Titus at Crete and said in Titus 2 verse 4, "Teach the older women to be reverent in the way they live, not to be slanderers or addicted to much wine, but to teach what is good. They then can train the younger women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled and pure, to be busy at home, to be kind, and to be subject to their own husbands, so that no one will malign the word of God." So this woman is very busy at home. She's working hard, whether it was in the Old Testament or here in the New Testament. But her focus isn't just primarily on the home, though it seems to be her primary focus. She then goes out of the home as well. Look at verse 14. "She is like the merchant ships." Not sure every woman would like to be described as that of a merchant ship, but she is like one, not in her size or frame, but in what she does. "She is like the merchant ships bringing her food from afar." Now, this is interesting. Every area of the world at that time, and more narrowly, every province would have had their local produce and their staple diet based on that local produce. So basically, it got pretty boring. You ate what you made locally, and that was that, morning, noon, and night. But if you wanted to enhance the diet of your family, you had to go to some other area to get what was growing there. And because she wanted her family to enjoy the meal she prepared, she was willing to be like a merchant ship that sailed to some foreign land to bring back some exotic food for the joy of her family. She added variety to their lives by trading goods produced at home for goods and merchandise that the household couldn't produce itself. She wanted to provide food that was nutritious and tasty and enjoyable. She moved her household from a subsistence economy to that of, in a sense, like a mercantile economy. And so literally what Solomon is picturing here is this woman going down to the ports where all the goods would come in from the foreign lands. And here she is, while she has looked after the family and has got things in control there, she then has time to go out and be enterprising in the local commerce and buying and exchanging goods. What she produces at home, she then sells it with the merchant traders. And then I ask this question, how does this woman juggle all these balls? You might be asking it too. Look at verse 15. She gets up while it's still dark. I told you, it gets worse. What else does she do? She provides food for her family and portions for her servant girls. Not only does the food have to be bought, which she's done, no doubt, down at the port and buying and selling with local traders, but she also needs to prepare the food for her family. She's clearly not the sluggard that Solomon has warned his sons about or not to be in the Proverbs. And as this lady of the house, she may not actually physically have made the breakfast herself. There might have been perhaps 20 or 30, 40 people living, in a sense, in this noble person's house. It seems to be a richer person that Solomon is talking about. But what she is doing is she's supervising the morning meal. That's what Solomon is talking about. But you know what is absolutely amazing about this? This lady actually gets up before the servant girls. Now, that would have been totally countercultural. The servant girls would have done everything for a wife like this, but because this woman is so filled with God, she gets up before the servant girls and actually makes sure that the food is ready to serve the servant girls, who will then continue to serve the family and all the guests for the rest of the day. See, this is a woman filled with God. This is a woman who shows no partiality based on who you are or your rank within society. But in case you think that's all she does, look at verse 16. She's got more to do today. She considers a field and she buys it. Out of her earnings, then she plants a vineyard. Clearly, she's a business head on her shoulders. She examines and weighs up what the most profitable enterprise would be. She buys a field fit for cultivation because she'll then plant a vineyard within it. But as she goes about buying the field, she then considers the cost. How much will the field cost? How much will be left over? How much do I need to plant in the vineyard? She keeps this budget all within her head, it seems. But what would she have had to organize in buying the field? The land would have had to have been terraced, a wall needed to have been built, a wine press hewn from stone, the soil would have been needed to have turned over with a mattock, a watchtower needed to be raised, and so this woman would have likely purchased all these things and project managed it. And she did this all because her husband was sitting at the gate of the city as an elder, and she was doing this all in her local area, primarily from her base at home. But what is interesting, Bruce Waltke, an Old Testament theologian, said this, is that she didn't have a competing career. By the wife's economic contribution, she has freed her husband to play a prominent role in public life, and she is functioning as a helper. And then he quotes Genesis 2, verse 18, when God said that he was looking for a suitable helper for his wife. And so she is playing this amazing role within the family household. But how does she do all this? You might ask, look at verse 17. She sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for her task. Now, does this mean that she attends the local fitness first? Back then, part of the local powerlifting club? No, not at all. This is a woman who knows how to roll up her sleeves. This is a woman who gets her hands dirty. She is not work shy. She is a woman of enterprise. She is a woman of energy. She is a woman of strong physicality. She is the sort of woman who gets up in the morning knowing she's got work to do. She is a self-starter. She has drive and determination. She's the sort of woman that gets up and attacks the day because there's so much for her to do, both in the home and in the local community. And then I thought, well, surely she gets home at night and crashes in front of the TV, wrecked. But she's not finished. Look at verse 18. She sees that her trading is profitable and her lamp does not go out at night. And I'm going, hold on, she's up. She's up before dark. She's up before the servants. She's making sure all the things are cared for before she goes out into the local area of commerce. And yet here she is at night still working. Because her business is going well, she has had to continue to work late into the night, and we cannot forget that she got up very early while it's still dark. After the sunset, she is supervising the sale of the vineyard's produce. This must have included the keeping of the books, counting of the money, and the goods. It's likely that the sun would have gone down about 6 o'clock in this particular Middle Eastern culture, and it seems as if she would have spent about 3 hours at night under artificial light doing, in a sense, the books for her local commerce in and around her family home. And then if you think she's finished, she's not. Look at verse 19. In her hand, she holds the distaff and grasps the spindle with her fingers. She's making clothes at nighttime. But how valuable would these woolen items have been as she works perhaps under the light of a lamp late at night? Historians tell me that in this time period, a good woolen garment would have cost over 2 months' wages and an expensive linen one about half a month's wages. So this woman from her home is bringing in a great deal of money to the family. But the question is, do her hands just make money for her own family, or is this her priority? No, not at all. This woman is not finished for the day. Look at verse 20. She opens her arms to the poor, and she extends her hands to the needy. Notice that she does not ship things out to the needy. Rather, she extends herself to the needy. It's not like she says, well, here's money to be pumped into the local community and the people that need it. No, she actually is giving of herself. She not only thinks, as one writer says, about profit for her own family, she thinks about the poverty of others. She is just as intent on giving to others as she is on getting. The Proverbs, again, has spoken much about ministry to the needy. Proverbs 11, verse 25 says, a generous man will prosper, and he who refreshes others will himself be refreshed. Proverbs 21, verse 26, the righteous give without sparing. And then I had another question. But what will this woman be like when hard times hit the family? Surely she'll drop the ball. Well, she does in verse 21. When it snows, she has no fear for her household, for all of them are clothed in scarlet. There would have been no central heating system that you could have flicked with a switch. Rather, the only way they heated their homes in the land of Israel in the ancient days was a flat pan of hot coals just radiating the heat through the house. And so you needed something to keep yourself warm. And the cloak they needed to wear to keep them warm is likely to be the coat that they would have slept in at night. They would turn this warm coat then into a warm blanket. And so she has made all these, and she or supervised the making of them, ready for snow time. Again, the color is significant. That's scarlet. Not that scarlet would have made them feel any warmer, although maybe the scarlet color does make some people feel warmer. But the fact that it would have been scarlet emphasizes the quality of the clothes. She wants her family to be warm in the winter. And so she has made sure that she has procured the right type of clothing for these difficult times. But she's still not finished, verse 22. She makes coverings for her bed. She is clothed in fine linen and purple. Because you might think, well, based on all that she's doing, in a sense, to keep the family household going, based on all the commerce that she's involved in, bringing the goods from her family, buying and exchange, and then coming back to the house, then looking after the books of the local vineyard that's sort of maybe around the house somewhere, surely this woman's dowdy. Surely she's stopped looking after herself. Well, it says here, she's dressed in fine linen and purple. She's looking good, though in a sense nothing, in a sense in her physical character, but she's making nice coverings for the family house and nice coverings for herself. One writer says she's an elegant lady, dressing well and decorating the home with pride. The linen that she is wearing would have been imported from Egypt, and the purple she is wearing would have been dyed fabric from Phoenicia. So she didn't just get that by staying at home and never moving. No, when she would have gone down to the local area of commerce, she would have been buying and selling, and she would have been looking for these nice goods for her household and also for her to wear. But she's still not done. She doesn't just put God and her family first. She's not just a woman of enterprise. But thirdly, she speaks wisdom to those in her life. Look at verse 23. She speaks wisdom into those in her life. Her husband, then, is respected at the city gate, where he takes his seat among the elders of the land. See, this is not a woman that is cutting out the legs from underneath her husband. This is a woman, because of the way she is living, she is thriving, her family is thriving, and her husband is thriving. And in fact, I believe if this elder was sitting at the gates where they would have disciplined people within the city and made rulings within the city, in fact, they might have said, oh, Joe is the or Joe's wife is called so-and-so. She would have been so well respected, that woman who lived like this. And then we hear more about her enterprise, verse 24. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies the merchants with sashes. She is clothed with strength and dignity, and she can laugh at the days to come. She speaks with wisdom, and faithful instruction is on her tongue. And the last time we were in the book of Proverbs together, we looked at Proverbs 4, and it says, whatever is in our hearts, so will come out of our mouths. The mouth speaks, so that is within our heart. And so as she goes about her family life and then into her life of commerce, as she moves out of the family and then back into the family, everyone that she interacts with, she's speaking wisdom into their lives. Why? Because she knows God. Because God is central in all that she does. She speaks wisdom and faithful instruction on her tongue. Just think of the wisdom she's pouring into her children's lives. Her children here seem to be her primary audience. There's no doubt that the woman feeds her husband all the right information that he will need to make in the decisions of his life. When she opens her mouth, it's not gossip, it's not slander, it's not negativity, it's not idle talk that she utters. It seems to be godly wisdom. She speaks with wisdom. Faithful teaching is on her tongue. But she's still not done. Fourthly, and lastly, she is praised by all who know her. Verse 27 summarizes, in a sense, all that we have known so far. She watches over the affairs of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. And in that culture, in our culture, for a man or a woman in a marriage, it can be easy to be a hero at church, a hero in our workplace, and a failure at home. It can be easy for me to be a hero in church, although some of you say he's never a hero, and for me to be a failure at home. It can be easy for a wife to be a hero somewhere out in the workplace or somewhere wherever, and yet a failure at home. But Solomon is saying, because her primary responsibility as a mother and a wife is her home, she's not dropping the ball there, but it's freeing her up to do other things with her time. She watches over the affairs of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. And then you might say, well, how would her family think about her? Look at verse 28. Her children arise and call her blessed. Her husband also, he praises her. And he says, verse 29, many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. And then Solomon has another word for his sons about beauty that is deceptive. He says, verse 30, charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. There's the key. The woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. It's a verse of contrast between the external and the internal. And there's nothing wrong, Solomon is saying, with external beauty. But Solomon is saying it can be a smokescreen as to what sort of person she might be. You hear people say about someone, watch him or her, they're real charmers. Because there's often deception behind it. Charm is deceptive, Solomon is saying. Beauty is fleeting. It's like a breath. It's here today and gone tomorrow. But a woman who fears the Lord, she's to be praised. And then it closes. Give her the reward she has earned, and let her works bring her praise at the city gate. As a lady tonight, whether you're single or married, you could go, what sort of woman could be like this? Or as a man, you could be saying, hey, what sort of lady is like this? Or how could I be married to such a woman? I couldn't even be in her presence. She'd be so intimidating. And yet there's another picture, I think, that's here. When we look at the Proverbs 31 woman, we naturally ask, who could live to such a standard? No one can. No woman can. They can attain to these things, but the Bible then tells us that one greater than Solomon has come, and he is Jesus. He's wider than all the wisdom found in the book of Proverbs. And yet the Bible speaks about Jesus as preparing for himself a bride, the church, to be presented before him in all her splendor. The Proverbs 31 woman leaves us looking and longing. Who can find her? Who could ever be her? But you know the amazing thing? Ephesians 5 says, Jesus is creating her. He's calling out a people from every tribe and tongue and nation and language as his bride. And one day he will return as the bridegroom, and there will be a great feast. And so as we move to the communion table in just a few moments, as we come and we look at this passage as a lady and we say, we can't be this sort of person. By God's grace and strength, he's calling us to live like this. And yet as a man, God is calling us to be the sort of man that can lead and honor that sort of woman in our singleness or in our marriages. So let's just pray and ask God to strengthen us, and then we'll sing and meet around the Lord's table.